From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman and columnist for Newsday Dan Revive. Welcome, Steve and Dan.
Pleasure to be here.
Hey, Kim.
Well, here are the issues. The U.S. House of Representatives voted to approve a special select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol building after a bipartisan effort failed to get enough votes to pass earlier. U.S. President Joe Biden made his pitch in the Midwestern state of Wisconsin for congressional passage of a bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure package to repair the country's crumbling roads and bridges and at the same time boost blue-collar employment. We'll look at the outcome of the first in-person meeting in Italy of the G20 group of nations since 2019, where leaders discussed COVID-19, climate change, and food security. Robert Godek, acting Assistant Secretary of State for the State Department's Bureau of African Affairs, said Washington welcomed the Ethiopian government's decision to declare a temporary end to hostilities, but warned that the United States will watch closely to determine whether the ceasefire results in changes on the ground. And former President Donald Trump toured parts of the U.S.-Mexico border where Governor Greg Abbott has vowed to build a border wall. This as New York prosecutors announced the first criminal indictment in a two-year investigation into Trump's business practices. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Dan, I will start with you. What will be the focus of this investigative committee?
Well, just the fact that there is a committee was something that we thought was a natural outcome of the events of January 6th. It was shocking to us who live and work here in Washington, D.C., that thousands of Americans assaulted the Capitol building where the American Congress sits. But in the months that followed, it turned out that nearly all members of the Republican Party, Donald Trump's party, did not want an official investigation, and almost all Democrats did. It seemed that the Democrats are hoping that Donald Trump will be blamed and that all of America will see that the events of January 6th were dangerous, that they were an insurrection, as the Democrats put it, and they would blame Trump and it would damage him forever. And the Republicans either try to protect themselves or Trump. So we have the select committee. It is certainly the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the Democrats, who wanted to be sure that there would be an investigation. And definitely it's the Democrats being in the majority who will be in the majority of this committee. So they'll decide what they look into. Do they hear witnesses? Do they hear them in public? Would some of the testimony be private, maybe having to do with the intelligence that the police, perhaps even the U.S. military had before January 6th, as to what those protesters wanted? We know publicly the protesters claimed that Donald Trump won the November election, but was there in fact advance intelligence that there would be an assault on the building with the use of violence against police? And it seemed that some of the insurrectionists wanted to capture, who knows, maybe even kill Vice President Mike Pence, because Pence would not support the notion that Donald Trump was the true winner. So there's a lot for the committee to look into. But one thing I'm wondering right now is if any Republicans at all will agree to sit on the committee. I'll just point to two names, the only Republicans who voted for setting up this committee: Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, and Adam Kinzinger, a Republican from Illinois, who's absolutely been critical of Donald Trump. Cheney has been as well. Other than that, Republicans are acting like they want nothing to do with this.
Yes, that just brings me up to my next question. And Steve, how will the Republicans' role in the probe and the appointments to the panel help determine whether the committee becomes a bipartisan effort or a tool of further division?
Well, it most certainly is going to be a tool of further division, because the Republican leadership is going to do whatever it can to try to sabotage this committee, most likely by trying to appoint some of those who may come up in some of the testimonies. Leader McCarthy has basically indicated that if any Republicans, such as those that Dan mentioned, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, accept offers from the Democratic speaker to sit on this committee, then he might strip them of their committee assignments. So it could be political suicide for any Republican to accept Speaker Pelosi's invitation to sit on the committee. And whatever happens with this, the Republicans are going to call this a bunch of political theater. Their big fear, of course, is this all comes out, the conclusion of it, right before next year's midterm elections, and this becomes a campaign theme for the Democrats and perhaps could have some influence with independent voters.
Yes, and as Dan had brought out earlier, the panel's going to be investigating probably a number of things. But I'll throw this out to both of you. Why do you think it's been so difficult to get to what led to this violence on the Capitol? And how will the committee get to the root cause?
Well, the Republican point of view is that the Democrats unfairly want to blame Donald Trump. And the way things stand right now, just over 5 months since Trump left office, the Republicans look to the future. They look to who their best campaigner will be in the congressional elections next year. They look to who their candidate for president may be in the year 2024. And so far, Donald Trump seems to be the leader of the party. And so the Republicans want to defend Trump. The Democrats, they say they want to find out the truth. What was the planning behind this insurrection, as they call it, of January 6th? But certainly I hear from Democrats that they're sure that Trump was behind it, and so they want to openly blame him.
And Steve, did you want to comment on that as well?
I would just add that, again, this is all about the midterm election. And as Dan noted, having Donald Trump out there as the best campaigner for the Republicans, there are some Republicans who fear and some Democrats who welcome the fact that this possibly could backfire because you would have Donald Trump endorsing more extreme candidates in the primaries who win the nominations for these congressional seats and then are considered too extreme by independent voters, and they would lose seats in the House in a year where they would be expected to gain seats and possibly retake the House, which typically happens in a midterm election after a new president has come in. So this is much more than just an investigation about who did what and who knew what before January 6th. It is really going to be a pivotal report that has the potential to influence who controls the House after next year's election.
President Biden argued in Wisconsin that his infrastructure bill would benefit working and middle-class families around the country. And in speaking to reporters at the White House, he said he would not sign the bill unless another sweeping proposal of Democratic priorities were included. So, Dan, what is the next step for Congress at this point?
Well, to kind of put together the various plans that are aimed at improving America's infrastructure, a lot of focus on highways and bridges. For years, we've spoken about American airports. And anyone who visits a lot of these, you know, public places and public buildings can see that they need repairs. They need it. But for many years, Congress has considered infrastructure, usually considered that it's too expensive or the two political parties couldn't agree on how to do it. Now we do have a breakthrough. President Biden sat with members of Congress of both parties, and there seems to be a plan which President Biden is traveling to support and campaign for. He's certainly putting the focus on bridges and highways. Republicans still criticize it for having too much in there that's not just bridges and highways. But the White House says it's really important that it includes also the ability of all Americans to have high-speed internet and other technological features that America will need in the future. Is that part of infrastructure or not? In fact, in the House of Representatives, the Democrats and the majority, they say they have some Republicans on board to pass a package aimed at transportation. $715 billion. But you may know that the president is talking about several trillion dollars, several times what even House Democrats are supporting. I still don't think they're all on the same page as to how much they're willing to spend and exactly on what.
Right. It's a question of money, but the expectation is that there is enough bipartisan consensus to get something passed, and it will leave some lawmakers unhappy, both in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and some of those in the Republican Party who don't want to see any sort of successes or victory for the Democrats in the early days of the Joe Biden presidency. Yeah, when you throw other things in there, such as broadband for all, a lot of other lawmakers willing to go along for that. But for many of them, when it starts to go beyond that, and these aren't the type of traditional infrastructure projects, there's a lot of hesitancy to support it.
But here's an unfortunate fact in American politics. One side wants to claim credit, or both sides want to claim credit. There's always blame being assigned. So keep in mind, November of next year, that is now just 16 months away, right? The entire House of Representatives faces election or reelection, about one third of the U.S. Senate. The Democrats are in charge of both the Senate and the House. So here's a question. Do the Republicans want Congress to succeed at this, or would there be political reasons that the Republicans don't want success right now so they can blame the Democrats? You can turn that around on the other side, whether the Democrats are in a rush to get something done just so they can look good, even if it costs too much money and leaves a gigantic national debt.
Yeah, it all depends, I think, for some of these Republicans, how secure they are in terms of reelection. And if putting an advertisement on television taking credit for getting a new bridge built across the river is going to boost your chances against a challenger, then they'll probably vote for this bill.
All right. Some Republicans might.
Well, you both raised some very interesting points, and we will see how this develops within the next few months. It's time now for a quick break, and when we come back, we'll look at what came out of the meeting of the G20 foreign ministers in Italy and a warning from the U.S. to Ethiopia. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman and columnist for Newsday, Dan Raviv. Well, Dan, G20 foreign ministers called for multilateral cures for some of the global crises like COVID-19 and the effects of climate change. So how are they expecting to work together on these challenging issues?
Well, not everybody sees it the same way, even in the group of 20. It's very broad. And if I really take away the biggest division that I think will stay with us for quite a while, it's between the United States and China. Joe Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, made a real point of saying that we're no longer in the era of Donald Trump and that the U.S. Wants to work with allies. He said a strong multilateral system is essential. And China's foreign minister seemed to go off on a very different direction. He was extremely critical of Western nations, including the United States. He said the calls for multilateralism are just empty words, and rich countries are hoarding the COVID-19 vaccine. And by the way, just a few days later, President Xi Jinping of China gave a speech, marking the important 100th anniversary of the founding of China's Communist Party. And President Xi absolutely said that if the Western countries keep criticizing China, and clearly he meant on human rights and other issues, that they're going to meet a great wall of steel, that all Chinese people will stand against that. And so I'm just very struck at that event where Antony Blinken was there representing the U.S. and the other foreign ministers are there, mostly, I'd say, from Western countries. China was just saying that it's sick and tired of hearing high-sounding slogans. So China and the U.S. have a lot of work to do to repair relations.
Yeah, the G20 obviously is not the G7, and expecting that wide of a group to be a united and very effective mechanism, especially when you have Washington and Beijing representing two of the countries of the G20 in there at loggerheads, you'd have to be optimistic that they're going to achieve much. And really, we are more and more in this sort of bipolar war, where during the Cold War, it was the United States versus the Soviet Union, but now it is very much the United States and China a lot of countries are hesitant to line up 100% behind either country. And so this sort of rhetoric that we see coming out of Beijing is really very alarming, especially to the European countries that want to have, first and foremost, solid economic relationship with China, France, and Germany, notably.
And let's move over now to Ethiopia, where the U.S. warned that Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions from the administration if the announcement of a cessation of hostilities does not result in improvements in the Tigray region. So then, Dan, what could the U.S. possibly do in this particular situation?
Well, I don't think there's any chance that the United States is going to send in peacekeeping troops. I will allow for the possibility that if African nations were to put together a peacekeeping force, the U.S. would give some support to that. But you may know that Ethiopia is a very major player in all African Union decisions. And so if the Ethiopian government does not want foreign troops involved, it's not going to happen, and it probably won't. I think what the U.S. State Department was suggesting was that the United States might declare that one side or the other is committing genocide or war crimes or crimes against humanity. We'll see what phrase they might use. So far, a senior State Department official told a congressional hearing that the Biden administration feels that horrifying atrocities are being committed in Tigray. And I think the thought was, frankly, that Ethiopia's forces are doing it, though, you know, many feel that both sides are doing it. Of course, in this conflict, who is stuck in the middle, right? Non-combatants, right? Civilians. Thousands of people have been killed. 2 million people have been displaced. And once again, famine may be coming to a major part of Ethiopia, and that will involve the United States and the entire world in trying to help ordinary people. So far, again, the U.S. position is, quote, we will not stand by in the face of horrors in Tigray. But we have yet to see what the U.S. might do.
Well, the U.S., I think, is going to be forced to put some action behind those words eventually. There's a tremendous amount of pessimism that this ceasefire is going to hold. A spokesman for the Tigray forces calls it a sick joke. The Ethiopian military is poised to re-enter the regional capital within weeks if necessary. So this is a fragile ceasefire at best. And as Dan noted, it is the civilians who are the victims here, who are caught in the middle and are going to suffer the most.
And also at this hearing that was held this week, Sarah Charles from the USAID Humanitarian Assistance Bureau, she really talked about this, and she brought up that without a scale up of assistance, we could again see widespread famine in Ethiopia this year for the first time since the 1980s. So what is the international community doing at this time? I know you all touched on this issue.
Oh, international aid organizations are gearing up once again to help civilians in Ethiopia, in Tigray, and still there are efforts in other parts of East Africa, of course. But yes, once again, the focus is on Ethiopia. And that's why I was kind of struck, you know, in that group of 20 meeting of foreign ministers in Italy, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said that he looked for robust action to push all parties to a negotiated ceasefire to resolve that conflict in Tigray. One other thing to keep in mind when I look at it, I don't want to put it perhaps in such blunt terms, I don't think the United States cares exactly who wins. The United States wants stability because in many parts of the world, when there's civil war, when there's civilians dying, the result is more radicalism. And it's very bad for America. Terrorist groups, you know, could set up terrorist training camps. All sorts of anti-Western forces can go in when a vacuum is formed. I think the U.S. just wants stability.
Right. The focus here in Washington is really on the people there. And the U.S. Agency for International Development is saying that it estimates as many as 4.5 million people already need urgent humanitarian food assistance and up to 900,000 of them are already experiencing catastrophic conditions. The question is, if you have renewed combat or you have militias and military forces trying to block access to getting aid in to these civilians, you can only imagine how bad the famine is going to get.
That's a very worrying concern that I'm sure the international community will continue to watch. Just wanted to get our final topic in with just a few minutes remaining. Former President Donald Trump toured parts of the U.S.-Mexico border as New York prosecutors announced the first criminal indictment in a two-year investigation into Trump's business practices. So I'll just get a comment from each of you. What can we expect from this criminal indictment?
I don't think we really know yet where it's going to lead. Is it going to lead to possible criminal liability for the former president? That's not happening in the first round. But of course, what prosecutors always want to do is they want to use some of the smaller fish to get the big fish. And they've gotten one of the fish now in custody, the chief financial officer for the Trump organization, who is a longtime confidant of Donald Trump and his business empire, a guy named Alan Weisselberg. He is believed to still be quite loyal to Trump, but we've seen some of Trump's past loyalists breaking with him when they realized what sort of criminal jeopardy they're in. Trump obviously wants to stay in the news and be relevant both for the 2022 congressional elections and the presidential election 2 years after that. This is not a way he wants to be in the news. Potentially, this sort of prosecution against his organization could be very damaging for his business, making his hotels essentially radioactive for any legitimate business establishments.
Steve, you said that, of course, the former president doesn't want to be looked at in that way, right, as someone whose company is facing criminal charges and his longtime financial aide faces criminal charges. And who knows, investigators might be going after something having to do with Donald Trump and his family. Trump, in fact, wants to be noticed. No question about that. This past week, he had a rally, quite large, in Ohio, right? People were cheering for him and looked again like President Trump at the microphone. And he was speaking, you know, very freely, supposedly in support of a Republican candidate. But it was mostly about Trump himself. And he said that the good times could return. He was hinting that he might run for president again in 2024. He claimed that Joe Biden has been squandering all the hard work and success of the Trump years, and said that the Biden administration is bowing down to America's enemies all around the world. In addition, Trump said that Biden is letting a rising number of illegal immigrants come into the U.S., right across that southern border. And then Trump dramatized that by visiting the southern border with some Republican members of Congress. My takeaway from that is that the Republican Party thinks that illegal immigration is still a powerful issue, that Trump himself is signaling he really might run for president again in 2024. And we'll see if the legal charges in New York will dent his ambitions.
Yeah, the trick is really going to be making what Trump campaigned on to get elected in 2016 work 8 years later. But that's been his habit. I was in the White House for his 4 years, and he stuck to these themes. He did not waver at all. But the question will be, yeah, you were in there for president for 4 years, and you could have really turned things around, and now you're blaming your successor for that. Of course, Trump is also maintaining that he did not lose last November's election, and what is called the big lie will permeate through the base and really motivate the Republican electorate to get out for either Donald Trump or whoever he chooses to back in 2024 and oust the Democrats from the White House.
Lots of great topics that you all gave great analysis on. We'll have to wrap up on that note. My thanks to our panelists, VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman and Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.